Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Baseball season is around the corner, and we will be giving out our favorite futures picks on the Just Baseball Show in the lead up to opening day. To go along with that, BetMGM has a brand new offer for our listeners. Use code JUSTBASEBALL and place your first BetMGM Sportsbook wager through the BetMGM Sportsbook app of at least $5, and you will receive $150 instantly in additional winnings regardless of your wager's outcome. How to get this offer? Step 1. Download the BetMGM Sports app on iOS or Android or visit BetMGM.com. Step 2. Sign up and deposit at least $5 into your newly created account. Step 3. Place a wager in the amount of at least $5 at standard odds price. Step 4. Once you have placed a bet, you will receive $150 in bonus bets regardless of the outcome of your wager. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369 in New York and call 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 21 plus only, please gamble responsibly. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona, 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa, and 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use code JUSTBASEBALL and get $150 when you bet at least $5 on your first wager.
And Bonds, high, it's a game!
Final installment of the positional rankings. We're talking top 10 relievers today on the Just Baseball Show. I'm Aaron Layton. He's Jack McMullen. Before we get into that, though, a couple topics to hit on. Brian Bello gets an extension with the Red Sox, a nice little pre-arb deal. We're going to discuss that. That comes on the heels of bad news that we talked about with Lucas Giolito. So some good news that the Red Sox can lock up some of the minimal pitching that they have. Unfortunately, paying the same guy more or extending him doesn't give you more pitching for this coming season. So, but we're going to focus on the positive there. And then beyond that, Josh Donaldson retires. Phenomenal career. Famously a very likable and enjoyable guy on the baseball field, but we're going to talk about what, you know, he did in terms of, I think when guys limp to the finish line a little bit, it's easy to forget how dominant their peak was and their prime was. And Josh Donaldson's was as good as just about anybody in recent memory. So we'll talk about that. But Jack, first and foremost, how you doing? It's been a fun kind of stretch here as we're getting deep into spring training, but unfortunately, as the last episode kind of highlighted before, we had some awesome conversations with, you know, Grayson Rodriguez, and we've been getting injuries, man. We're kind of at the injury portion of spring training where guys start to get ramped up a little bit, and as that happens, they go down. So I'm glad to have some good news today on the Bayo front, at least.
Yeah, it stinks that we're dealing with all the injuries. I will say we're also hitting the good point of spring training where the early injuries, we're getting more clarity, and, you know, chances are it's less doom and gloom than maybe you initially anticipated. So Kyle Bradish, right? He shows up to camp and it's like, oh, Kyle Bradish has an elbow sprain. Is he done? What's the deal? Like, are the Orioles already, you know, packing it in for 2024? No, we recently got an update that Bradish is throwing without pain. He's up to about 140 feet and he'll hop on the mound very soon. He's throwing flat grounds. That's great. Vaughn Grissom, likely still not ready for opening day, but Grissom will be back. It seems like maybe a week or two into the season. There are a bunch of guys like that where they show up to camp. They're not 100% right. We got a Verlander update too. He hasn't started throwing yet, but he's got a timetable now. I'm excited that we can put some of those early concerns in the rear view. Having said that, it's never fun when like Sonny Gray pulled a hammy and now we got to sit without him for five starts. Because anytime we get to watch Sonny Gray, it's a better day. Anytime that we get to watch the Red Sox trot out an adequate starting pitcher, it's a better day. And I'm excited to see Bayo. I don't know what's going to happen for the other four spots, but you know what? Godspeed to the Boston Red Sox.
Well, and I don't know if we've talked about it on previous episodes. I can tell you we didn't talk about it, Peter and I, last episode. So I don't think it's been discussed, but Shane Baugh is a little bit of a setback. Fortunately, yeah, you know, for the Rays young star pitcher who could be so freaking good, it's an oblique. Obliques suck from the sense of it does take a while, especially for hitters. You know, it can be nagging and you want to take your time, but that's way better than a setback of, you know, I wouldn't even call it a setback. I'd really call it a delay in the recovery. Setback almost implies that he had something wrong with his arm. It's not good news, but at least if he's going to get a delay in his recovery and have a little bit of an ailment, that it's not his arm. So that part is good. But unfortunately for the Rays, that is going to delay what is, you know, what we're kind of waiting for, which would be the full flight, you know, really talented young rotation. They're already extremely injured, so they can't get Baugh back soon enough. But unfortunately, they're going to have to wait, and you're not going to want to rush him back from an oblique. So now when you look at the rotation, a lot of stock into Taj Bradley, who is still looking pretty good lately. I think the last outing, throwing that split, it looks good. But Zach Littell, Pepe out, I think, you know, we feel really good about him. Savali's a safe arm. Eflin's good. But, you know, Baugh is the guy that can be a difference maker for them. And I think we're going to have to wait a little bit longer to see him.
Which stinks. And, like, you know, Baugh and Casey Mize, I think I was having this conversation with Javier Reyes yesterday. Baugh and Casey Mize fall into a similar bucket because they've been out for so long. It's like, does that guy still exist? They went under the knife at the wrong time. Like the timetable didn't make sense for them to come back at all in 2023. So they have to pivot to the start of 2024. And it feels like they have just been off the grid entirely. Tampa's a different beast than Detroit because Detroit has run out a bunch of guys. And Mize, if he's throwing well, he immediately inserts. Glasnow was in this rotation, like, at the end of last year. Pepiot was not. But we were looking at a rotation last year that could have been, at its best, McClanahan, Glasnow, Springs, Rasmussen, Eflin. We were talking about a guy in Zach Eflin who was 170 innings and a mid-3 ERA that, like, might have been the sixth-best pitcher heading into the 2023 season. And now we're talking about a rotation that was six deep with great arms last year. One and a half deep now. Eflin, I think Savali's the other half. And they're, granted, we love Pepiot. We love the idea of what Pepiot could do this year. We love the idea of what Taj could do this year. This is a rotation with one and a half proven arms at the major league level. And it's concerning that you don't get another one of those extremely exciting low effort 99 guys on opening day.
Yeah, well, if you're going to have limited proven options, of course, Baugh's not proven either. But, you know, you want to have more irons in the fire with high upside young pieces. You figure Pepiot, you hope Pepiot, Bradley, and Baugh all perform. But, you know, you feel better that the more of the high upside guys that you have, at least two of them are going to be able to do something for you. But I still think they all can. And Baugh, it's just going to be a little bit of a detour here. But I love what I've seen from Pepiot. I know you do too, and Bradley is looking really solid. That splitter will be a nightmare tunneling wise off of his, you know, riding fastball. So they've got it. You know, they'll be okay for now, but Baugh could be that jolt that they really need. But again, that jolt might be coming a little bit later. Red Sox fans needed a jolt, and I don't know if this is going to be enough to make them happy just yet. I know it's been a frustrating time for them, but I will say this is a team, an organization that definitely needs to solidify pitching. We know that Breslow and now Kyle Bodie being in the fold, like, that's been the focus here, right? We know they've got so many talented bats, both at the big league level and then all the way down through the minor leagues. So many talented offensive prospects, but pitching wise, it's thin. You know, Pivetta's a fine option. Crawford's a fine option. But outside of that, you know, you're hoping Whitlock can stay healthy. The only young and projectable arm that I think you can count on for 150 innings this coming season is Brian Bello. And, you know, I know Pivetta's going to be able to eat innings, but he's on the other side of 30. If we're talking about a building block for the future, it's Bello. And he's coming off a year where I think he showed a lot of good things, but I was surprised that he ended up being the guy that gets this extension. I think on any other team, he's probably I don't think any team's opposed to extending him, but he's probably lower on the totem pole when it comes to priorities. But with the Red Sox, I mean, this is one of the few young pieces they have. And they sign him to a 6-year, $55 million pre-arb extension that will give them another year of control and then technically two, because it's a club option at $21 million. But that's pretty favorable for Bello in his age 31 season. It's an interesting deal and one that I get it from Bello's perspective. If I'm a pitcher, I'm taking the guaranteed money.
Yes.
Especially with all the injuries you see across the game right now. And Bello gets that. He'll hit free agency, presumably at 32 years old. And for the Red Sox, they get two more years of control here of one of their few, you know, solid, young, semi-proven, and still projectable arms.
The thing that strikes me about Bello is the Red Sox just paid for durability from a guy that was durable last year. And since he has debuted, has been durable and was durable in the minor leagues before that. Bello is by no stretch of the term nasty. I want to make that abundantly clear. He's a guy that's going to eat a bunch of innings. I have a lot of concerns about sinker changeup guys. Brian Bello is a sinker changeup guy, and we can get into the arsenal there. The best case scenario for Brian Bello is 200 innings at a 60% ground ball rate. And he is one of the better young starting pitchers in baseball and inducing ground balls. But he's outside the top 75% in baseball. I think he's 26th percentile in K rate. And he's like in the bottom 15% in hard hit rate. So the ball's coming off of barrels. He's not punching guys out. I think it was like 7.5 punch outs per nine. He's never going to be the filthy frontline guy, which is why he was never in the market for a 9-figure deal. But amid 8-figure deal across this many years where they buy out 2 years in the open market, you're buying a guy that you hope is going to flirt with 200 innings every year in the middle of your rotation. I think that can be the guy. The question is, what do those 200 innings look like? Is it a 4-5? Is it a 3-7? I don't see a world where it's a 3-2. The gold standard of sinker guys, ground ball guys, is Logan Webb. Logan Webb is nastier than Bello is. And Webb's going to give him 200 innings, but he's also going to limit hard hit balls like that. I worry about the financial buy-in for a guy that you're hoping is, I don't know, better than Kyle Gibson.
Yeah, I think there's the fact that he's 24 years old. You know, the changeup's gross. I agree that the sinker changeup guys are tough because you're just not going to get a lot of whiff. You're not even look at prime, you know, prime, but prime Sixto Sanchez, right? Is a perfect example where
for those 11 starts.
Yeah, no, but like in the minors, even though you look at the minor leagues at the upper levels, people be floored by the lack of swing and miss because everything is it's a similar action. Everything's at the bottom of the zone. Hitters feel like they can eliminate the top of the zone. And, you know, he's going to work on buzzing a four seamer up more. And I think that this is probably Craig Breslow and Kyle Bodie betting on the fact that they can help develop him and maybe turn him more into that low threes guy, mid threes guy. And it's possible. But I think the reason why you feel good about this contract is kind of what you talked about is this guy that's going to get a lot of ground balls in a hitter friendly ballpark and eat innings for you at the very least. And that's important. You know, I think that's something that one, they really need. Two, you want to have for the foreseeable future. And, you know, I think the Red Sox, realistically, they see the young core that they have. They probably figure that they can really compete in 2-3 years. Yeah. And, you know, they want to have Bello for a few years through that window, and they're able to extend him now. So it's a 6-year, $55 million deal with the team option that would, for $21 million, that would bring it up to 71. Or sorry, it would bring it up to $75 million. Yeah. So I guess there's some buyouts and little, you know, things here and there that can make it interesting. But yeah, so it's fascinating because I think it's a no-brainer that they're going to pick that up, assuming that he's pitching anything near what we think he's going to do, you know, at the end of this deal. But the other side of it is this. So this is from The Athletic. It's from Jen McCaffrey, who does a great job covering the Red Sox here. But I thought this quote was interesting. It's not even a quote. This is what she wrote in here. Bayo's emergence as a future number one starter working alongside Pedro Martinez in the offseason near his home in the Dominican Republic has given the club their first homegrown starter since the days of John Lester and Clay Buchholz. Given that, signing him to a contract extension was a priority. Look, I know he's super talented. I don't see future number one here. He's also not being paid to be a future number one here. Like, this is still the same amount of money with more years of the Sandy Alcantara deal, which was a couple years ago for – and that was, again, before Sandy really made that leap. Maybe he could make the leap. Sandy was a sinker and change-up guy, but Sandy's also a freak and elevated the four-seamer, found that – develop the slider. Like, I don't know if I have confidence in Bayo being able to do all that, but I do have confidence in Bayo getting better. And especially with the people that they have at the helm, yeah. You know, in Boston, in the front office with Breslow, with Bodie. So let's say he gets better. He's a good three potentially. And an innings eating three at that contract. That's a no brainer.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. They wanted to try to show fans, I think, that, hey, we're going to keep some guys, especially the homegrown young pitching, because we haven't had much of it lately. But this kind of tells me that the new, very forward-thinking pitching minds are bullish on Bayo. And though you and I may kind of think he's more of a middle rotation arm at best, maybe they do too, but they feel very confident that he can be that. And, you know, those are two minds that know a lot more pitching than we do. So, I think Red Sox fans should feel good about this contract no matter what.
It's hard to leave Pedro Martinez's house after a winter of pitching with him and be the same as you were last year. I feel like you can just sleep in the guest bedroom and leave better. He is surrounded by the right people. And, you know, Kyle Bodie, contentious or not, he clearly knows what he's doing when it comes to pitcher optimization. Is it always the best thing for pitcher health? Not necessarily, because there is an over-reliance. There is a reliance on velocity. I don't want to call it an over-reliance, because over-reliance would be saying that it's a bad thing. And at the end of the day, velo is what gets guys to the big leagues. So I'll call it a reliance on velocity and a reliance on max effort. I think the best version of Bayo could be that max effort where he's, you know, ticking up to 97. And then he's got this crazy changeup with a bunch of, you know, like late dive on it. And it plays just well enough off of the sinker. And the slider has to get better. Like, has to. Yeah.
And he's got to buzz a four seamer a little bit, and it's the hard thing with these guys who tend to be pronators. They struggle to command the four seamer, specifically struggle to rip, you know, breaking balls and sliders. But being able to buzz a four seamer would help a ton. The other thing is, you know, and this was also something that The Athletic noted, was that it's pretty much similar to Hunter Green's. Six-year, yes. $53 million extension last spring. Green comes with a little bit more injury history, obviously a lot more upside. Do you think that's kind of a fair comparison? I mean, not in terms of fair comparison, because it is the similar deal, but in terms of, do you think that's a good value for Bayo, considering Green has more upside but more risk, is also, you know, lacking some things with his arsenal as well, and I have a lot more confidence in the Red Sox now being able to get the best out of Bayo than the Reds, you know, trying to figure out exactly how to get that third pitch to be a consistent offering for Green, though he's a freak of all freaks.
I can see the similarity, and I can see where that came from in that Athletic article. What I will say is the Reds locking up Green early felt more similar to the Marlins locking Sandy up early than it does the Red Sox locking Bayo up early, because of the market size. You've got a small market team in the Miami Marlins, or at least they operate like a small market team. You got a small market team in the Cincinnati Reds, those two see a future ace and they try and get in on the ground floor. Here, they may see a future ace, and that's the rhetoric at least surrounding this extension. That's what we heard on ESPN on the Thursday telecast, Red Sox, Braves, JetBlue, whatever. They could see a middle of the rotation arm. The way that I look at it, I'm going to compare it to a catcher, is Kiber Ruiz at Washington. It's a very similar number to the one that Kiber Ruiz got. And Washington, although they've kind of fell out of the limelight in the last couple of years, they've been willing to hand out big money contracts. They gave it to Corbin. They gave it to Strasburg. They can operate like a Boston Red Sox size team. They have the money to do that. And they saw Kiber Ruiz as a guy that at his best is a top 10 catcher in baseball, but probably not above eight. At his worst is a top 16 catcher in baseball. That's how I think the Red Sox view Bale. At his best, he's a low end two. At his worst, he's a high end four.
Yep. I think that's a great comp. And you know what? That safety is valuable too. That's expensive too, right? So, and he is a little bit safer, you know, than I think some other pitchers that you might give these kind of deals to. The last thing I'll note on this before we quickly talk about Donaldson and get into these top, you know, relievers in baseball is that I feel like it's one of those situations where, you know, you mentioned the small markets, and I think that's an important point because it doesn't matter in free agency because someone would just outbid you. But if you have a pitcher here and they're leveraged, you know, any rookie or young player is going to be leveraged because the way that our system works here in baseball, where the amount of years of control that teams have over you, they're going to say, hey, we're not going to do more than $55 million. I know you're potential frontline guy, but here's $55 million guaranteed. You'll give up a couple years, you know, on the back end, take it or leave it. Whereas I think with a team like the Red Sox, as you mentioned, though they've been cheaper of late, there's a little bit more, I think, back and forth here where it's like you're capable of doing a little bit more than this.
Yes.
And I think that does help a bit more with Bayo's case, because I do think, to your point, if Bayo was playing for the Marlins or the Reds, they probably pull this deal off for a little bit cheaper. And that just kind of comes with the territory of pre-arb deals with big market teams. I still think the Red Sox did pretty well here. They needed to at least solidify some sort of building block in that pitching staff, and they did that here. Do you have any final thoughts before we move on to Josh Donaldson, Mr. Wonderful?
I don't think so. I don't want this to come off as me being negative on Brian Bayo, because I'm very positive about who Brian Bayo is. I just think it's unfair to call him a future frontline starter and the face of the Red Sox rotation moving forward. They need to complement Bayo and the security blanket that Bayo has with frontline elite guys. If the Red Sox sign Blake Snell or Jordan Montgomery and they put him in front of Bayo, I feel way better about the Boston Red Sox moving forward.
I'm with you 100%. And the last thing I'll say is I'm looking at the pitch data on his slider. You know, even at spring training, but the shape looks mostly the same. It, you know, hasn't been doing much for him there either.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be sinker changeup. It's going to be below average whiff numbers. It's going to be elite ground ball numbers, a lot of weak contact, and being able to eat innings. Until that fastball at the four-seamer or that slider makes a big leap, I don't see him being that frontline guy. It doesn't matter. It's still a good contract, but I did want to clarify that too. I agree. And especially the command. I mean, the four-seam fastball last year, below 60%, you know, strike rate. So he just really didn't have a lot of confidence buzzing it up there, and it got hit hard because it still ended up kind of morphing with the sinker. And then the slider, 53% strike rate. It's got to be better than that. And even when he did land it for a strike, got hit pretty hard. So that's something you got to work on, but he'll be 25 at the start of the year. And, you know, he's got plenty of time there to continue to get better. And Red Sox seem to think he can.
Yeah.
Josh Donaldson. He's retired. He's hung it up. And it felt like it was about time. You know, it was a limp to the finish line. He obviously was going to finish out that last deal where he got paid pretty nicely. But he exchanged hands from the Twins and to the Yankees. And then, you know, we saw a little bit of a stint with the Brewers and that infamous Rowdy Tellez story of him kind of coming into the locker room, not really saying anything in the clubhouse. And Rowdy says, hey, like, we introduced ourselves around here. And he said, you know who I am. Well, that's kind of, you know, and that was on foul territory, by the way. They do great stuff over there and a hilarious conversation. But you know what? He's right. You do know who he is, because he had a really good career. He won an MVP. He had a near 9 WAR season. He also followed that up. I mean, his peak, man, when you look at the peak between, which was, I think, really when he emerged in 2013 with Oakland, and then followed that up with another dynamite year in Oakland, and then two, I would say three phenomenal years in Toronto. Mm-hmm. That peak there, if he could have, and there's a lot of guys you could say this about, but if he could have sustained that for another, I even think 3 years, you might have a Hall case. But he couldn't sustain it. He got up late. He was a late bloomer. And instead, we're talking about Hall of very good. But it was a really good career for a guy that, you know, I don't think anybody would have expected this outcome if you checked in 2010 when he was 24 years old, fighting for playing time at the big league level with the Oakland A's.
So Josh Donaldson, during that five-year peak that you're talking about, this guy was consistently running a K rate right around 18%, which was below league average. It was good. So with a K rate that was better than league average, that five-year average from 2013 to 2017, this guy would hit 280 with a 380 OBP, a 900 OPS, and then he would sprinkle in 32 doubles, 33 homers, 98 driven in. Those were his averages across that five-year stretch. 900 OPS, getting 30 and 100. He was one of the better power-hitting run producers that we had in baseball. The duo of him and Jose Bautista created some excellent memories for baseball fans, regardless of where you lived in your formative years. If you are my age, if you are Aram's age, like, we're both 26 years old. We were watching Josh Donaldson do that when we were freshmen, sophomores in high school, and we were like, this guy's sick. You were playing third base. You probably wanted to be like Josh Donaldson.
I mean, I tried the swing in the cage a couple of times. I just
couldn't. Yeah, with the huge leg kick and like you just pissed.
I couldn't sync it up. It didn't work. I tried it from the right side. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And from the left side, forget it. It had to be as simple as possible.
Can't do it.
I tried the barrel tip and the leg kick. I couldn't do it. But no, I anyone who played third, I latched onto. And you know, once I kind of saw the way he carried himself.
Then you opt out of the Donaldson experience. Yeah,
pivoted over to Arenado, but I was always an appreciator of the bringer of rain. And, you know, you look at the defense too. It was up and down, but there were stretches where it was really good, especially in that MVP season. That five-year stretch is what I really want to key in on here, though. You mentioned the slashing line. You mentioned the fact that he walked or struck out only 18% of the time, walked at a near 13% clip. 5 years here, a 33.6 F4. That is an insane five-year stretch. Insane. And again, like if he was able to, and that's a big if, obviously, but you duplicate that for five more years, and you know, you're looking at, I mean, that's enough WAR to get you in the Hall of Fame. That's 67.2 WAR. Like that's crazy. And then you could just trickle in, you know, whatever he got at the end of the year. He did have that one little fever dream year with the Braves where he put up a 5-1 season. And then, you know, he was actually decent for one more year with Minnesota back in 21 when he hit 26 home runs and put up a 3 WAR. I mean, he was really competitive and decent up until I'd say the back half of 22. And then, you know, whatever you got, you know, last year. But it really was a phenomenal career that if he got up a little bit earlier, you know, we might have a different conversation here. But phenomenal player, phenomenal career, you know, polarizing guy. I wouldn't even say polarizing. I think most people just didn't like the way he carried himself. But you know what? You don't have to have dinner with everybody to appreciate their greatness on the field. And it was a phenomenal career. So happy retirement to Josh Donaldson. And congratulations on all the success. Because, again, I think he exceeded – anybody's wildest expectations of him, you know, given and what was he?
He was a catcher.
Overall pick.
48th overall pick as a catcher out of Auburn.
Yeah. And started to, I think, kind of flame out. Like people were not really sure what it was going to look like. So it's cool to see it, you know, all come together and turn into a nice career.
One more
Anything
thing
else
real
on
quick.
Donaldson?
Yeah. One more thing real quick. I like the Jaws score on Baseball Reference for the seven-year peak. And I think Donaldson is a great example of the seven-year peak was awesome. The rest of his career, not so much. I was actually just having a conversation about Michael Young this morning. A great trivia question thrown my way. There are eight guys since 1965, and I won't have you play right now, but if you want to play in the YouTube comments, go ahead. Eight guys since 1965 to have five or more seasons of 200 hits. And Michael Young is one of them. And I was like, wow, Michael Young, it was five straight seasons of 200 hits or more. And it's like that guy's five-year peak was awesome. But aside from that, not so much. Donaldson, he was solid outside of his five-year peak, but that five-year peak was amazing. You look at Jaws score, you look at a seven-year peak WAR. Josh Donaldson, his seven-year peak produced 41.7 WAR. The average 7-year peak for a Hall of Fame third baseman is 43.3. So he's within 2 WAR of the average Hall of Fame third baseman. Problem is, you look over the scope of the career, the average WAR for a Hall of Fame third baseman is like 69-70. His is 47. So he's more than 20 wins lower than the average Hall of Famer. But in that peak, in that 7-year peak, he's right on par with a Hall of Fame third baseman.
And that's Baseball Reference WAR, which is also, yeah, you know, what's used in the JAWS, which, again, you look at both and usually they're both going to be in a certain tier there. And that makes sense. I mean, so Baseball Reference liked him even more when you look at the WAR perspective. And it's a good point. Again, just gets up a little bit late, you know, runs out of gas with some injuries in the back end and unfortunately comes up a little bit short. We're going to get into the top relievers in Major League Baseball, the final top 10 on the Just Baseball show here in a moment. Before that, a quick break.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
All right, Jack, this is the final top 10, the final one. And it's kind of fitting that we're going to do it, you know, with, I guess, have the conversation with a bunch of guys that are closers, that are closing games out here. And some of the best. And it's really hard because there's so much volatility at this position. It's the most volatile position in the sport. That's why, see, a lot of teams, you know, kind of have a revolving door of relievers. But that's why I think with the rankings here, we wanted to try to value. Of course, the most recent year is going to be extremely important. But for me, at least, I can speak to myself. Like, when I was ranking guys, yeah, of course, if you're one of the best pitchers, you know, relievers in the sport last year, you're going to be up there. But the guys that have been doing it for a couple years are going to separate themselves because, I mean, this position is just volatility 101.
Yes. I think it's important to note that these change all the time. And number 10 on this list may end up being number 2 by the end of the year. And the guy that's medically DQ'd, for my money, is number 1. But, like, it's fascinating to me how quickly all this shit changes. And a guy that was never even sniffing this list, I'm thinking about like a Ryan Tepera or an Aaron Loop. We were talking about those guys getting 3-year deals at the end of the 2021 season. And now they're out of the game pretty much. Tepera, I have no idea where Ryan Tepera is right now. If that guy throws a major league inning, like, let me know. Shoot me a message and tell me, hey, Ryan Tepera's on the mound for the Oakland A's right now. I love how volatile it is because everybody seems to get their opportunity in the limelight, but it makes some of these guys at the top of this list all the more impressive because they've been there for the last 5 years or so.
No doubt. And we'll dive into some of the things that make them extremely unique. Obviously, we were talking about it before we recorded. A lot of these guys are going to have great fastballs and great sliders.
Right. Like, but we can just say, oh, yeah, sits 98, wipeout shit. Crazy.
Yeah. But we'll try to key in on some things that make them unique. You mentioned the medically disqualified guy in Felix Bautista. You know, I mean, he'd be right at the top. It's insane what he can do. It's one of the more uncomfortable at-bats you're going to have from a 6'8", just monster of a man who looks like he's handing the ball off to the catcher. But honorable mentions, and you want to do evens or odds before I mention the honorable mentions?
What do you want to do? Your choice.
I'll take the evens.
Okay.
So we'll do honorable mentions here. Pete Fairbanks, Jose Alvarado. This is one of those where, you know, Fairbanks with Tampa Bay, Alvarado with Philly. I think you could have made the case for Alvarado to be in there. I was kind of surprised to see him come up a little bit short. But then you look at all of the other options, and it's like, who are you going to remove? And that's where we were kind of at. Alvarado battled some injuries through last year, but ended up coming back and finishing strong. I think with Alvarado, it's a perfect example of phenomenal last year, but it was only 41 and a third innings, 1.74 ERA is unreal. But, you know, 2022, it was a 3.18. 2021, it was a 4.20. And yes, this was his best year, but it was also the smallest workload we've seen from him since 2019. So unfortunately, just missing a little bit of the track record that some of these other guys have.
Yeah, important note with Alvarado, don't call it a sinker. It's a cutter. It sits 93. And like the fact that he, or a slider, pardon. Don't call it a slider. It's a cutter. But he is this, you know, heavy set left-handed arm that is busting 99 in on lefties' hands or working away from righties. And then he runs this mid-90s cutter in on righties, away from lefties. It's so hard. It's so overpowering. He's a fun guy to watch, especially in the postseason when sitting 98 turns into sitting 100. He was the fun one in that bullpen, I'd say, because Kimbrel induced a ton of stress. Dominguez got to be hit or miss at points during the regular season that kind of bled over. Alvarado was the one where it's like, okay, he's on the mound. I feel good.
Absolutely. And Fairbanks, another guy that, I mean, when healthy,
he's just been great.
Last season and change, you know, we had 45 and a third innings this past year and then 24 the year before that. You combine that, you got 69 and a third of 2.08 ERA, 25 saves last year in 49 appearances, and the guy struck out a ridiculous amount. I mean, nearly 14 batters per nine. Again, I think just a little bit more of the workload wasn't there. The other guys we're going to talk about it, we're doing this over more innings, you know, more save opportunities, where just more pitches thrown. That's going to matter. It's got to matter here, especially when we're already using small sample sizes because they're relievers. There's a big difference between 70 innings and 45 innings versus, you know, when we're talking starters, 160 innings versus 135 innings. Yes. That's a big difference too, but not nearly as big, relatively speaking. So that's what keeps Fairbanks just out, a guy that could be easily in the top 10. But that leads us to the top 10, which is me, right? I'm doing evens here. So yeah. I'll jump in here. Number 10 on the top relievers list is Andrés Muñoz of the Seattle Mariners. And Muñoz, phenomenal year yet again, 52 appearances, 13 saves, 49 innings, a 2.94 ERA. Underlying numbers liked him even more, a 2.70 FIP. More than 12 strikeouts per nine. He can get a little bit wild here and there, but keeps it in check enough, four walks per nine. And, you know, you look across the board, I would say most of us were in the same area, except for Leo. Leo had him at 15, one of our editors in Leo Morgenstern, but you had him at nine, I had him at nine, Pete had him 11, Fink had him at eight, and Colby had him at eight. There's some diabolical stuff here, and it's going to be the classic fastball slider, yeah, but this slider can be a nightmare for hitters.
That's the thing that jumps out to me about Muñoz. Everybody gravitates towards the gun with him because he is up there with Yoan Duran and Felix Bautista and Emmanuel Clase when it comes to consistently grabbing 100 miles an hour. Muñoz can run it up to like 102, 103. But 102, 103 is not his best pitch. It's the slider that's his best pitch that works off of it. That's 92 to 93. So a guy that is, you know, making headlines and is blowing up Twitter because he hit 103 miles an hour, and the fact that you can call that his second best pitch lands him on this list alone. Because who throws 103 and that's not their bread and butter? It's him and Durant. Durant is 103, but that's splitter's his best pitch. And obviously we're going to talk about Yoan Durant. Not right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where he'll blow by you, but you're almost, I don't even know what you do in this kind of at bat. Do you just key in on the fastball and hope you get it?
Yeah.
He probably picked up on that because he ends up throwing the slider 50% of the time last year. So like the slider is too good of a pitch for guys to be able to sit on and really try to hit. He allowed two home runs on it last year. And for the most part, just, if even if you got it, it was going to be weak on the ground. The average the 50th percentile exit velocity on a slider last year was below 87 miles an hour. It's just that's just crazy stuff. But then again, you're a sitting slider, then he's going to blow 99 or 100 by you. 11 miles per hour in separation between the slider and the fastball is huge here because I think a lot of guys, it's hard and harder, and this is still technically hard and harder, but there's a lot of separation there where if you're sitting fastball, you're going to get an ugly swing off. And if you're sitting slider, you're toast if it's a fastball. And that's why Muñoz has dominated hitters for a while now. But what kind of puts the icing on the cake for me is 32% strikeout rate, 58% ground ball rate. You get the best of both worlds here with Munoz. So unlikely to, you know, blow saves or blow games when, you know, you also are able to get that contact on the ground.
100%. But let's jump to number nine here. And number nine is Alexis Diaz of the Cincinnati Reds. Alexis Diaz is the big little brother of Edwin Diaz, 27 years old. This guy threw all the time, 71 appearances last year, 37 saves, was near the top of the National League. In 67 and third, he had an ERA just a little bit over three. The FIP was good, punched out 11 and a half guys per nine, and he accumulated almost two WAR. Same deal. We all kind of had him in the same range except for Leo. I think Leo ranked 15. He probably had Alexis Diaz like 16. The thing that jumps out about Alexis Diaz is it's not 100 by any stretch. It's for the most part 94 to 95 that he sits with a four-seamer. The slider is one of the better sliders in all of baseball. Starting pitcher, relief pitcher. Opponents last year against the slider hit a buck 53. They slugged under 230 against the slider. What he does delivery-wise is almost identical to Big Bro, and Big Bro's slider might be the best slider in all of baseball. And I don't have the extension numbers in front of me, but I have to assume that the extension is crazy and the arm angle is crazy. And the way that those guys jump forward on the mound and snap that shit off is unlike any other pitcher in baseball.
The extension's elite.
Is it? Yeah.
MLB average extension's around like six and a half feet. He's 7.7.
They pretty much do, Edwin and Alexis pretty much do the Carter Capps thing where they just like jump forward on the mound.
It's pretty damn close. It's like, because they ban that, so they pretty much toe the line quite literally of what they're, you know, allowed to do there. And that causes the fastball to get on a lot quicker. Of course, Diaz is arguably the most unhittable pitcher in the sport because Edwin.
Yeah, Edwin.
Because he does that at 100. And you mentioned the velocities, you know, more, I would say 93, 95, you know, more 94, I would say 94, 95 can grab six and six and change. But he also has a low release. And with that extension, it still gets on you like it's upper 90s. With Edwin, it gets on you like it's
110,
105. Yeah, like something crazy like that. But, you know, that extension, I think the low release really allows the slider to play up off of that, and it's just a nightmare for hitters. I think the numbers are only going to get better and better for him. And you know, again, this is another guy that he had a couple little blips, but it ultimately settled in and had a good year. But if you look at 2022, a 1.84 ERA, yes, the numbers weren't as great in 23, but I think when you look at the 2 years, the body of work, he's not slowing down anytime soon.
You don't often see reliever extensions. When you do see them, they tend to come in small markets. Emmanuel Clase got extended by Cleveland. I think Alexis Diaz in Cincinnati is a perfect extension candidate. I think David Bednar in Pittsburgh is a perfect extension candidate. Those two guys in the NL Central get in on the ground floor and make them lifers in their small marketplace.
I agree with you. Another guy that could end up being an extension candidate is Camilo Duvall with the San Francisco Giants, because it's getting hard to justify. Yeah, I think not, or I would say it's getting hard to believe that he's not going to continue to do this year in and year out. So the number eight reliever in Major League Baseball is Camilo Duvall. 2023 was just another good year for him. And it just, he just seems safe, comfortable. Your heart rate's not really high at all when he comes into the game. Even when he gets in a jam, you feel like he's going to get out of it. 69 games, 39 saves, 67 and two-thirds innings, a 2.93 ERA. The underlying numbers like him even more, a 2.77 FIP, 11 and a half strikeouts per nine, 3.5 walks per nine, and nearly a 2.4 there, right at 1.9. Leo, again, the low guy, has him at 10, though. Everybody else had him anywhere from 7 to 9. 7 was the most popular rank with myself, Peter, and Colby. You had him at 8. I mean, Duvall is just another one of those guys that the ball just explodes out of his hand. And that's kind of a prerequisite to be on this top 10. But with the hard, hard cutter and then this fastball that just gets on you, it's one of those things where I just don't know what you do in these kind of at-bats. You guess for one, similarly we were talking before, and just hope you get it. But the difference is he'll mix in some sinkers and he'll mix in some cutters. Like, he'll just give you different looks. A slider with more sweep, a cutter that's closer to the upper 90s, the fastball that's averaged 100 last year, by the way. And then a sinker that's like 98. He can give you more looks. Of course, the majority of the looks you're going to get are going to be sinker, four seam, and four seam and slider. But the fact that he can just sprinkle in some other stuff makes it really hard to even guess. And, you know, your best chance is just guessing against this guy.
Well, it's a guessing game more than any other pitcher that we've talked about to this point, because the slider usage, I've got at 36%. Where do you have the slider usage? Probably mid-30s, right?
Yeah, right around there.
So that's a mid-30, and that's his most often used pitch. He's got a three-pitch mix. So we're looking at 36% slider. I'm looking at 33% four-seam cutter, and then I'm looking at 30% sinker. Like, just pick. It's hard to eliminate two, because chances are you see those two if he can ID which two that you eliminate. And he's not going to miss enough to run himself into trouble. I think this guy is one of the better young relievers that we've got in the game. And you can see the year-by-year improvement.
Yeah,
this guy will jump into the top five at some point, it does seem.
Yeah, and as I said, the track record's there, right? We saw him debut at 23, end up pitching in the postseason, put up great numbers there in 2021. And then 2022 was just dynamite. You know, the 2.53 ERA. The ERA goes up a little bit. And it's funny, 67 and two-thirds innings in 2022, 67 and two-thirds innings in 2023. But you mentioned he's gotten better every year. He was better last year than he was in 22. You look at the underlying metrics, you look at the swing and miss numbers, you look at the walk numbers, they were all better. The thing with the reliever, you give up a couple home runs, and that can make the difference of the 2.53 and the 2.93. Underlying was great. He had more saves, same workload, and again, more strikeouts, less walks, less homers. He's going to be a dude, and the fact that he continues to get better, not he already is a dude, but the fact that he keeps getting better at 26 years old, look out. And you got to eliminate the sinker and the cutter probably if you're a hitter. And so you're sitting slider or fastball. And then the probability just swings into his favor when he also can sprinkle in those other pitches. Another guy that, because of that sinker, when he's not striking you out, he can get a lot of ground balls, 52% ground ball rate last year.
Yeah. Let's jump to number seven here. And number seven is Lafayette College alum David Bednar of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I love the backstory about David Bednar. This guy was a 35th round pick out of Lafayette College. Is Lafayette D3? I think it is.
Disrespectful. Patriot League.
Sorry. Oh, Patriot League. That's my bad. What the hell? I didn't think I would make those mistakes, but here I am. 29-year-old native Pittsburgher, undrafted out of high school. He goes to Lafayette. He shoves. But even then, like, you don't get the respect there. So he's a later round pick. This guy, in turn, becomes this dominant reliever, and he flies through the minor leagues. And David Bednar last year, we're talking about a guy that had an ERA right at two, at two flat. He had just under 11 punch outs per nine. He wasn't walking anybody in the front half. I think walks per nine was under one. It finished under three. And he is constantly on the mound, 67 and a third. He was a 2.5 win player as a closer. The book on Bednar the last 2 years is that they will use him until he is literally exhausted. And it resulted in injury in 2022. But Bednar is willing to take that on. He is now a multi-time All-Star. He is a workhorse. They love him in Pittsburgh. He should absolutely be extended by the Pittsburgh Pirates if they see him as the closer of the future. And they damn well should see him as the closer of the future. The fastball is mid-90s. It's not high 90s. If you can key me into the shape, I don't understand why no one can touch that thing. And he is a hefty guy. He comes from a slot that is pretty much overhead. He's got that fastball that he locates so well at the top of the zone, and then he snaps off a true curveball. And that 1-2 punch of the fastball curveball is disgusting.
Yeah, and it's just a tunneling nightmare for hitters, and that's been abundantly clear. But you mentioned just the track record here. You got 3 years now after a couple shaky stints with the Padres, gets over to Pittsburgh and a 2.23, a 2.61, and then the 2.00. The other thing is just keeping the ball in the yard. The home run to fly ball rate just dwindling by year and only at 4%, 3.8% last year is extremely impressive, especially when you're a guy that likes to buzz the fastball, as you mentioned, at the top of the zone and then snap that breaking ball off of it. To show you in terms of the shape, it's 18 inches of vert, which is slightly above big league average, but he gets slightly more extension. The big thing for him is the vertical approach angle. So his angle is super flat, just the way that the ball comes out of his hand, and it just makes for emphasized carry that you're not going to see on the sliders on Savant. We don't have VAA on Savant, but that's something that really exacerbates the carry and also exacerbates the tunneling effect when you have that downer curveball as well, and then the split that he'll mix in there as well. It just seems like riding upwards, two things that look like the fastball until it's too late, and bite downwards, good luck. And those are, that's the type of arsenal that's not going to have any platoon splits.
No.
When it's vertical, everything's vertical, you're going to be able to get lefties and righties out. Similarly, righties hit 211, lefties hit 220, and that's why he is as consistent as they come.
I love the North-South guys. Marco Estrada was the first one that I fell in love with. This is much better than Marco Estrada, because Marco Estrada was like 88 and then 77 with the changeup. This is, I've got that at the top of the zone, and I'm going to snap hell off. The sticky version of James Karinchak was my favorite reliever to watch, because he was North-South, and it was, I'm going to spin a 3,000 RPM fastball and then like a 3,000 RPM curveball off of that, and you are not going to touch it. And as much as you can do without the tack, that's what David Bednar is doing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And Karinchak is about as vertical as they come. So that's a great example of that, but made for some really, really uncomfortable at-bats. That brings us into number six here. And somewhat polarizing on our rankings, Brian Abreu, the Houston Astros, checks in. I mean, what this guy did in the postseason through stretches was utterly insane. But at the same time, like, you got to start looking at what he's done the last 2 years. And I mean, look, I know he's not closing games out, and there is some, value that we baked into that when you're picking up saves.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're talking about a sub 2 ERA over the span of 132 and a thirds innings for the Astros.
2 years.
2 years, we have a 1.84 ERA. I mean, that is all I need for a guy to be in the top 10. His stuff is diabolical. Like, in terms of just swings that guys get off, I don't know if there's a guy that gets more, like, pitching ninja swords out there that we're going to talk about, maybe other than one or two of the guys at the top. But in terms of guys outside of the top five, Abreu's up there with anybody. It just seems like everything is going in a different direction. I don't know what it is from a data standpoint that makes him so tough. I think it's that the curveball is just, you don't see curveballs in like the mid 80s. So it's like a power curve.
Right.
The slider, of course, is just disgusting and tough to pick up, I think, separating from the fastball. And then the fastball, just the life on it, is just something that I don't know. It might just be hard to quantify, that it just seems to just get on hitters and make them miserable. But Abreu had some of the more insane stretches we've seen, if you even spilled it into the postseason. And I don't know if we've really seen guys like Abreu very often put together stretches like that, especially relievers with the volatility of the position. Yes, we see really dominant seasons, but it's hard to remember a guy that's had the sub two for two straight years like that. And then also the stretch of like nobody reaching base or like no runs scored for so long spilling into the postseason.
A couple of notes when it comes to Brian Abreu's ranking. Colby didn't rank him. Colby had him out.
That's insane.
That's like, come on, man. We talked about it with the starting pitchers. Like,
was that an oversight? Could that have been? Did he forget?
It could have been. I don't know, man. Like, maybe he sorted by saves and looked that way. I don't know how you missed that. But he did save five games. Peter had him at six. Do you remember the conversation we had during the postseason? I think it was actually on Twitter. I could probably go back in my tweets and I can look at it. Peter said that he would rather have Brian Abreu than Felix Bautista on the mound. And I was like,
say that.
Yeah, he said that. And he was like fully convinced during the postseason. And the thing is, like, is that a knee-jerk reaction? Yes. Did I understand it a little bit in the moment? Yes, I did. Like, immediacy is a hell of a drug, but it's also like, dude, what he was doing in the postseason, he did look like the best reliever in baseball.
I mean, in the postseason, it was some rare stuff. Like, he did look like nobody had a chance. It reminded me of like when you have the mature like little leaguer that just looks like a man compared to everybody else, just comes in, no one has a chance. That's what he looked like through stretches. So, I mean, now we have 130 innings of work to highlight as well.
To back it up, yeah.
It's hard to justify. And on basically any other team, he's racking up saves. So I don't care about the saves as much here. I think people do look at like the left on base percentage, things like that. But I also think that's a testament to the stuff when you're a reliever. And I mean, the stuff, I'd stack his up with anybody, and he's still just 26 years old. I think the fact that he also has that banger curveball that he doesn't throw in that much, but throws it in just enough, is what kind of just makes it even more difficult to figure out what you're going to do against a guy like him.
It's utterly insane to me that you mentioned 26 years old. He's entering his age 27 season. He'll be 27 for the majority of the year. He still has all 3 years of arbitration ahead of him. He's making 1.75 this year in his first arb year. The Astros they have like the discount of all discounts. If this guy somehow hit the open market at this point, he's a nine-figure closer. He's getting an $100 million deal. I do believe that because of what he's done the last
year. You think Abreu can get that?
If he hit the open market right now at 26 years old.
Sick. I mean, he'd be getting a big check for sure.
Last 2 years, sub two, he sits 98. He's got that curveball that you mentioned, and the slider is so good. Like, how are you paying him? I mean, if Hader just got 100, I think you give him 100 too.
Yeah, he should be in the top five then. But again, I think Colby just kind of like tanked. He probably would have been ahead of number five.
I would think so. Last thing on Abreu real quick. He throws like he wants to punch you in the face. And I'm in on that. Like, he's a menacing human being, and he throws like he is, you know, going to beat the shit out of you later. All right, number five on this list is Emmanuel Clase of the Cleveland Guardians. And it's crazy that Clase only checks in at five. This guy was throwing all the time, 72 and two-thirds innings. He made 75 appearances and 44 saves. The problem is, this guy was going to be number one or number two on like every list for the last, what, after 2021, after 2022. The problem with 2023 is we saw the K's tick down drastically, and he might have been living too much in the strike zone. He wasn't walking anybody, two walks per nine. But for a guy that sits 101 with a cutter to only punch out 7.5, 8 guys per nine, it doesn't make much sense at all. Having said that, this guy, even though he was in the zone a lot, still managed a 3.2 ERA. FIP was under 3, and he was nearly a 2-win reliever. Clase fascinates me because the K numbers aren't there. It is more fascinating to me than Gratterall. Because Gratterall, I kind of get it, right? You can track the sinker. You just bludgeon the ball into the ground against Gratterall. With Clase, that shit's moving, man. Like, it's cutting. It's a slider. I just don't understand where the K's were this past year.
So I think it's almost the same thing as we're talking about with, like, the change-up sinker guys.
It's the same movement. It's just different speeds.
And it, well, because Clase's cutter or fast, it'll get labeled as fastball, but it's a cutter. It's a gyro cutter, meaning that it breaks downward. So having that gyro cut to it, and sometimes it'll have a little bit more horizontal, but it'll usually have a gyro break to it. That's why you see the 58% ground ball rate. But then the slider, it's a little bit more horizontal, but it's still got a little bit of vertical drop to it. So he's got that similar situation where everything's kind of at the bottom of the zone. The thing is, though, is you're not going to be able to square this up. Like, it's just when it's 99 with like gyro cut, good luck. It's like Graham Ashcraft, we're talking about that, like it's a similar shape, and that's why those guys get a lot of ground balls, but you may not get quite as much whiff. There's another guy that it's just not going to happen because I think he naturally cuts, but if he's able to, you know, elevate, if he was able to elevate a little bit more, and he still does elevate the cutter, like it'll back up and it'll be really good for him, but he just wasn't able to do that with consistency. I think it was a lot of times by accident. That's why I don't think there was as much whiff. But that said, dude, like I feel so safe with Class A because even his quote unquote down years, or like where he's not getting as much of the lights out whiff as we're used to, he's just so solid because he's going to get a lot of weak contact. He's going to fill up the zone. He doesn't walk anybody, 5% walk rate, and it's mostly on the ground. So yeah, it was not his best performance that we've seen, but he's just such a shoo-in to to just be a solid arm for you and a solid high leverage arm. But I want to see him get back. He's got to miss some more bats to get back to that elite closer role.
100%. The cutter, I love it because 2019, I've got samples from 2019, 21, 22, 23. And he is, for the most part, like 60 to 70% usage with that high 90s, 100 mile an hour cutter. This guy's average launch angle against that pitch in 2019, it was 3 degrees. In 2021, negative 2 degrees. In 2022, negative 3 degrees. In 2023, negative 2 degrees. That speaks to the safety you're talking about. You know this guy is just going to get a 60% ground ball rate when he rolls out of bed. And he could be 97 with that cutter. He could be 95 with that cutter. It really helps that it's 102. But like when he's 31 years old and he's sitting 96, he's still going to induce that 60% ground ball rate because it's going to be one of the heavier cutters in baseball still. The only way this guy turns into a finicky, volatile reliever is if that cutter goes away. And it's hard to think that that cutter ever goes away.
And that's natural for him. And yeah. And I think that was just the difference. Yeah, we saw less swing and miss, and that's the difference between what, a 129 in 2021, a 136 in 2022, and then the 3-2.
And then a 3-2, yeah.
But I think the other thing we got to talk about is the usage, like how much he has been used. I don't think anybody's been used more in terms of appearances in the last 3 years than Class A, right? We saw 71 games in 21, 77 games in 22, 75 games in 23. I mean, that is outrageous usage. And to do that with a not even a sub-2 ERA the first 2 years, we're talking a sub-1.5 ERA, like a 1.29 and a 1.36. So yes, it was a little bit of a step back last year, but even then, still solid. I think he's going to be somewhere between what we saw, you know, last year and what we became used to the first 2 years, which with high usage is still a top five reliever in this game at the very least.
I'm looking it up right now. I got to do not qualified. I'm going to do minimum 5 innings pitched, most appearances since the start of the 2021 season. Emmanuel Class A is literally number one by a decently fair margin, by 7 appearances. He's made 223 appearances since the start of the 2021 season. Tyler Rogers is second. Hector Neris is third. AJ Minter fourth. Scott Barlow fifth. There are only 10 guys that have made 200 or more appearances since the start of 2021. Class A is at 223. So he's on a different level. And they constantly go to him and he constantly answers the call, which is cool.
That is awesome. And that leads us into number four. A guy that has constantly been there, though he just won't do it back to back very often. Josh Hader is a number four reliever in Major League Baseball, now on the Houston Astros as well. We're talking about two, you know, the best relievers in baseball on this Astros team. It's going to be scary. But Hader, it feels like he's been around longer than he has. I feel like because he's been one of the best closers, if not the best, you know, through stretches for a long time now. I mean, we're going back to 2017, where even when he wasn't picking up saves, he was dynamite for the Milwaukee Brewers. Pretty much ever since he's made the switch from starter to reliever, it was game over. Like, it was just lights out, disgusting stuff. This guy as a major leaguer, and now we've got a pretty good sample size here. 388 and two-thirds innings as a major leaguer. 15 strikeouts per nine. And we had whatever the hell 2022 was from him, that 5.22 ERA. But if you look at the underlying metrics there too, you know, 3.45 FIP, 2.94 xFIP, even the xERA 3.51. It was a bad year, don't get me wrong, but the underlying numbers were better. And then you look at what he did last year, he's back. And that's why the Astros paid him a lot of money to close games for them this coming season. 56 and a third innings, a 1.28 ERA last year. I mean, what he did for the Padres was ridiculous. Kept the ball in the yard better than he ever did. I mean, you could argue that, I know it was less innings, and we've seen him go 81 and 75 innings, you know, in the first couple of years of his career. But you could argue, statistically speaking, that this was the best year of his career in 2023. You know, either that or 2021. But they're both pretty darn close here. You can't argue that it's not one of the best, you know, 3 seasons of his career. So that's what made me really confident. Yeah, it looked like we were seeing maybe a decline, a little bit of Hader, but then he turns around and gives you one of the best seasons of his career. Astros go out and pay him. He's back, and he's one of the best in the game.
I'm going to make the argument that 2023 was actually the second worst year of his career. I'm kidding. 2022, opponents hit 225 against him. What do you think the second highest batting average against him in his career is?
Second highest. So what was last year?
Well, I'm not going to tell you because last year was actually the second highest batting average second against.
Batting average. Sorry, what did you say the lowest was?
So the highest was 225.
Oh, highest was 225.
In 2022. 2023, opponents hit for the second best clip they ever have against Hader in his career. What do you think that clip was?
192.
163.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to run you through this. The only year that he wasn't an all-star was his rookie year. In his rookie year in 2017, across 47 and two-thirds innings, opponents hit 156. After that, 2018, opponents hit .132 against him in 81 and a third. In 75 and two-thirds in 2019, opponents hit 155 against him. 19 innings in 2020, opponents hit .123. 58 and two-thirds in 2021, they hit .127. 163 is the second highest batting average against Josh Hader in his career.
So the second highest batting average basically was Mike Olt.
Yeah, Mike Olt. Opponents had a 508 OPS against him this past year.
That's so insane.
It's nuts.
That is so, so crazy.
2021 opponents had a 421 OPS against him.
So even his bad year, that's what I'm saying. Like that's why the underlying metrics are pretty good. Like you're still looking at a year where it's like,
yeah,
the ERA wasn't great. It seemed like a mental thing for him more than anything.
Totally.
It seemed like it was mental compounding. In terms of the release and the extension that he gets and just the way that he looks like he gets more extension than I think I don't know what it is because it looks like the ball gets on hitters way quicker, but the extension's pretty run of the mill. He must hide the ball well with its slingshot delivery. It just gets on hitters so quickly. He averages 19 inches of vert. It just seems like 19 inches from a 5.65 release height is pretty insane. Yeah. So he's just getting elite carry. The slider tunnels off of that. And then, I mean, that's all he needs. If you're a lefty, why even swing? But the funny thing is the last couple of years, he's actually had better numbers against righties, which almost like breaks my brain because the slider is his pitch. But I mean, this guy is a monster. So I feel like he's just going to be good as long as he's able to live in the mid 90s. And seems like he's fine living in the mid 90s as long as he doesn't throw back to backs too often.
But this cat was run out of Milwaukee because they might have had somebody better. And the number three guy on our list is Devin Williams of the Milwaukee Brewers. And it's crazy to think that guy could be better. But on a pitch-by-pitch basis right now, I think the answer is Devin Williams might be the better closer. Devin Williams this past year, opponents hit .097 against the airbender. He threw it 58% of the time. And then he threw the fastball 40% of the time. Opponents hit .177 against him. Devin Williams, 36 saves, a 1.53 ERA, 13.5 punchouts per nine. Leo had him one, understandably so, man. That changeup, is that the best pitch in baseball?
Probably. I was going to ask you the same thing. I said, how many pitches are you taking over Devin Williams' changeup?
No, I mean, like, you do the build your perfect quarterback. Everybody's taking Lamar's scrambling ability. Everybody's taking Tom Brady's, you know, leadership. Everybody's taking Mahomes' arm. If you're building a perfect arsenal, you're not taking another changeup outside of Devin Williams's. That could be the number one pitch off the board. I want Devin's changeup. And I wouldn't blame you if that was the number one pitch off the board.
We should do that one day. And it probably should be because he had a 23% swinging strike rate. What do you think? Do you have it in front of you? Like what opponents hit against his changeup last year?
.097.
Yeah, no, I wanted to see if you would guess. I would never have guessed anything below 100, even with his changeup. It's a screwball, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like I've actually asked a couple of hitters who have faced him and they've said it's like a left-handed slider. But the problem is it's even harder to pick up because it's a changeup and the changeup's the hardest pitch to be able to pick up and separate from the fastball. And because of that, the fastball plays up. Maybe nothing's insane about his fastball. It's some decent shape to it. Once he made the move from reliever to starter, similar to Josh Hader, it ticked up and it became a better pitch for him. But he gets off the chart, you know, in zone whiff numbers on his fastball because hitters are so domed up by that changeup. That's all he needs. And there's a reason why he throws the changeup almost 60% of the time and has no issue with it. And holds, I mean, when you throw a pitch almost 60% of the time and hold opponents below a 100 batting average, that's got to be the best pitch in baseball, or at least top three.
No, there are very few pitches that you can't do shit with. And one of them is Felix Bautista's splitter. Like, I don't see a world where a hitter can make contact with Felix Bautista's splitter. And of course it happens because it's baseball. Like, hey, 1 out of 10 hitters gets a hit against Devin Williams' changeup. I don't know how that works. But Devin's changeup, Bautista's splitter might be the two pitches that I'm like, I don't get it. And the other pitch might belong to number two.
Yep, exactly. That was what I was about to say, too. Number two, John Duran, the Minnesota Twins. I mean, his splitter, but put that up there, that splinker, whatever the hell that thing is, that demon pitch, you could put it up there with anybody. 26 years old. Amazing how many of these relievers are young as well. Yeah. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. So maybe the volatility around this position may start to slow a little bit. 59 games, 27 saves, 62 and a third innings, a 2.45 ERA. The underlying didn't love him as much, but still love him. 3.21 FIP, 12 strikeouts per nine, fills up the zone at a pretty good clip, 3.5 walks per nine. But I mean, it's he averaged 102 miles an hour with his fastball. Then you have that splinker that averaged 98.5 miles per hour. And, you know, those two pitches alone would be fine. And it could just be harder and harder. It's really extremely hard and harder. But he also has a curveball at 88. And that curveball probably looks like a Zach Greinke EFIS after seeing 102 and then seeing a splitter at 98.5. So that's what makes him, I think, incredibly unique. Is that everyone wants to talk about the splinker and wants to talk about a fastball that averages 102 and for good reason. But when you can also snap a curveball that has the depth that his has and gets the numbers that it gets, opponents at 135 against it last year, like, good fucking luck.
This is what we wanted Alex Reyes to be, but like bigger and more powerful. Alex Reyes was a top 25 prospect in baseball at his peak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, top 20.
That's a guy that the Marlins wanted in the Ozuna trade, and I think that, you know, the Cardinals were like, no way, take Sandy instead.
Yeah, I mean, Alex Reyes was arguably a top two pitching prospect in all of baseball at a point, because it was power stuff, because it was a pitch mix. All of a sudden, he moves to the bullpen, and you guys all remember that one season where he was the Cardinal closer. And it was disgusting. It looked like we were witnessing the start of a Hall of Fame career. And it's like, wow, starting pitching prospect learned how to close games. It's not Chapman, because Chapman was limited to a two-pitch mix. He added a third, and it's disgusting. But Duran is starter, closer. And he's got that starter arsenal still that, like, you consolidate into an inning, and 99 became 103. And that 84-mile-an-hour curveball became 88. And that splinker at 96 became 99-100. He's the guy that, like, in a shorter sample, is like, oh, I can just empty the tank. He is the best example of mentally emptying the tank, and he physically empties the tank across an inning, and it is the most dominant inning. If Jacob Mizorowski was a closer, he would look like Yoan Duran.
And that's the thing. He has that fallback, and now there's the track record of Brewers, you know, converting failed starters to relievers and becoming what they've become. I think you bring up an excellent point, though, here, dude, is aside from who we're going to get to at number one, a lot of the best closers are former starters. And I hate to say failed starters, because it doesn't mean that they would have totally failed. Yoan Duran may not have failed as a starter, but he might have been a four, you know, because the command would have been, he would have been like Edward Cabrera, like, leveled up, which is a little frustrating. Or instead, you have the best closer, arguably the number two closer in Major League Baseball, like, that's more valuable. You got to figure that out, though, and make that decision. But the guys that were former starters, they seem to just fill up the zone a little bit better. They're not really a two-pitch pitcher as much. And if they are, then they command the heck out of those two pitches. If you look at number, what, four, three, and two are all converted starters. And Class A too. Class A wasn't Class A a starter as well?
I think in Texas, and he failed. Yeah. What, he got popped for PEDs, and then he came back and he was out of the pen.
So 5-4-3. I know most guys are starters, but we're talking about guys that, like, started pretty deep into their minor league career. We're not saying, oh, they were starter, you know, in low A for a few games. These were guys that started for a while and then ultimately made the switch. And I don't think it's a coincidence that those guys end up being some of the best closers that you end up finding in the sport, which actually leads us into the best closer, who is one of the exceptions to what we were just saying.
He did start through his high A career, and he was kind of like a swingman in Double A. His first full year of being a closer was his first year in the major leagues. But the guy that we're talking about is Edwin Diaz of the New York Mets, which is crazy considering he didn't throw a single pitch in the major league regular season in 2024. Obviously, you had that horrible leg injury in the World Baseball Classic, and that just sucked the life out of
it. That's the closest I've been to throwing up from an occurrence that wasn't like visibly gross. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, I mean,
I've just been to like nauseated from a circumstance that didn't directly affect me.
Yeah. Like situationally, it was like, why the hell is this happening? It's the way that I can kind of look at it is Paul George, when he snapped his leg during that USA basketball scrimmage, Paul George was an MVP candidate at that point. So it's like, not only are you concerned about the guy and feel so bad for the guy because he just got hurt in a very bad way, but it's like, this just took away an entire year of this guy maybe being the best at his craft in the world.
Yes.
And Edwin Diaz, we lost a year of him being the best closer in the world because of that. And I understand how miserable that was in person for you, because I was watching it on TV and I was like, God damn it, this sucks.
Yeah, sitting in that and it's just waiting for any update in the in the, you know, post game like press box area. It was crazy, and you just weren't getting much. But that said, like, people were like, oh, okay, how is he still number one off of a knee surgery? Well, the arm's fresh.
Yeah.
My concern was like, how is he going to drive off the rubber? How is he going to land? And we've seen already he's more than comfortable. He's more than good. He had plenty of time to get back. There was a possibility that he could have made it back at the end of last season if they made the playoffs. They don't, obviously. So he gets way more time to ramp up properly. I'm pretty sure Uncle Stevie Cohen made sure that he had everything he needs.
Yeah, you go to what, Cedar Sinai?
Yeah, like he's all good. And you brought up a good point, though. He was a starter, man. We had he was starting games up until Double A. So it continues the point that almost all of these guys that are the best didn't abandon starting until maybe the upper levels, which, you know, I think is important here. He had one 9-inning start in low A in Clinton, which is pretty funny, but plenty of 7-6-inning outings, including a few at the Double A level. But just getting back to the point here is the reason why he's number one is it's going into 2024, who we think, you know, how we think they're going to stack up. I don't think anybody's going to be better than Edwin Diaz.
And
now he has a fresh arm. If the knee's feeling good, I mean, he's been sitting 97 in spring training, and I bet you he's, you know, in terms of like, I don't think he's even trying to let it go in terms of like, you know, some of the bullpens he's been throwing, things like that. I think by the time he comes back, he's gonna be sitting, you know, close to the triple digits number and flirting with. And when we've seen him sitting 99 the last couple of years, and I think now we're gonna see him pretty much right back there. He might even flash some higher numbers, you know, as he gets back into the flow of things because of how fresh he probably feels.
Yeah, I'll remind you of the numbers because they're really fun. In 2022, he had a 1.31 ERA and a FIP under 1, a 0.9 FIP, 118 punchouts to 18 walks in 62 innings, 17.1 strikeouts per 9. Opponents had an OPS of 4.46 against him. This is a number that I don't think I've ever seen, a 50% K rate in 2023. Yeah. Have you ever seen that at any level?
No. I'm trying to think. I mean, I've seen short stints of just dominant prospects that can get it into the mid-40s, maybe. 50, striking out half of the major league hitters you face is the epitome of just overpowering.
And not in 32 innings, in 62 innings.
That's the equivalent of 17 strikeouts per 9. Think about that.
Yes.
There's 27 outs to get. That is crazy. And the last thing I'll mention is 22, opponents hit a .157. But the slider, opponents hit a .110. But I think even more impressive is that they had an OPS under 300.
Yeah, give me the slug. I've got the slug in front of me.
It's 130.
Opponents slugged 130.
Slugged 130. That means, so that you know what it was? It was one home run. on that slider.
In 149 ABs that ended in a slider, one homer, oh, you know, no doubles, no triples.
Do you know who hit the home run? Any guess? It's quite hard to just pull out of your ass. I'll say traded from the National League to the American League and is an outfielder.
Traded from the NL to the AL is an outfielder.
Kind of stunk last year, relatively speaking.
I don't know.
Dalton Varsho had the one home run.
I love that.
103 off the bat there.
Man.
Think about that. One home run. And that was the only extra base hit. That was the only extra base hit he gave up on a slider that he throws 57% of the time. That we've talked about best pitch in baseball. That's probably the number two pitch I'm drafting. It might be. Might be number one. I might draft that before Devin Williams.
I'll take the airbender first. But Diaz.
32% swinging strike rate, Jack.
I know, but like opponents hit 097 against that changeup. It's so crazy.
That is crazy. Those two pitches, man. If you could put a pitcher together with those two and then, you know, Diaz's fastball too. I mean, what opponents are they're probably hitting 050, maybe worse.
So Cristiano Ronaldo has he's from Madeira, which is an island off the coast of Portugal. The airport is Cristiano Ronaldo Airport. If a pitcher had Edwin Diaz's slider and Devin Williams's changeup, he would have an airport named after him.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a perfect way to describe that. But Diaz, I think he's keeping number one, and or at least he's here to retake it for those who don't think he has the number one spot off of that knee issue, because, like I said, he's going to be fresh. And hopefully it'll be a nice little jolt for the Mets this year.
Yeah.
That's it. That was eventful going through all these top 10s. But, you know, I'm it's fun. I love doing it every year. But by the time we get to the end, I'm just so excited to preview teams, start getting into over under win totals, all that good stuff. So we will be doing that very soon. Jack, you could probably talk a little bit about the schedule we have moving forward, because you are the schedule.
The schedule czar.
Yeah, you are the schedule czar. I do want, before I kick it to you to do that, tease the call up, because yes, we've got some crazy interviews. I mean, I just put out conversation with Rhett Lauder, Benny Montgomery, and we're talking about, you know, first round picks galore, by the way. Rhett Lauder, Benny Montgomery, Robbie Snelling, and Snelling's coming out next week, but yeah. Robert Gasser, and then Reggie Crawford, who, you know, talked about just recently focusing on pitching, no longer being a two-way guy with the Giants. But then coming out next week, we've got a crazy loaded, you know, call-up schedule with Matt Shaw, Robbie Snelling, Dylan Lesko, Dalton Rushing, all of them on the show for about 7 to 10 minutes apiece. Really good information. There's about another 10 more insane top 100 prospects that are going to be on the episode. I'll be putting it out over the course of like 2 to 3 more episodes on the call up, but definitely go check that out. It's legitimately like 15% of our top 100 list. So we'd love for you to check that out. And speaking of that, the top 100 will be out relatively soon. So keep an eye out for that as well.
We are going to have a Just Baseball Show episode dedicated to the top 100. We will have over under win totals in the American League and the National League. Just like we do every year, we pick every team against their number over under on the wins. We will have our player awards episode, and I want to do X factors in each division. I'm very excited for X factors in each division, because I think that there is an X factor per team that we can look at and say, okay, this guy could put him over the top. Spoiler alert, Carlos Rodon, I think, is the biggest X factor that we have in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and well, it's not it didn't look too hot last time out. So hopefully
X factor.
hopefully we can get it going. And the Yankees fans are probably looking at another X factor already, but I agree with you, especially with, you know, what they're paying him and what they're expecting him to do and what we know he can do. So looking forward to all of that. Keep an eye out for, you know, the top prospect episodes coming out, you know, continuing to put out those interviews, and really fun stuff ahead on the Just Baseball Show. And of course, you can check out the website where we're churning out a ton of really fun stuff and really insightful and informational stuff to get you ready for this season, help you win your fantasy leagues. Go check out the Just Fantasy Show and all that good stuff as well. As always, thank you for listening. Look forward to talking to you guys next week.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports.
With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.